Douglas Holtz Aiken is the president over at the American Action Forum and joins us now. Douglas, always good to see you here. Love to get your reaction to the former president's comments on the debt. Do you think, how concerned are you about the level of debt in this country? And do you think we're at the point where it will start to impact our economy?
Well, I think the level of debt has already begun to impact the economy, and I'm more concerned about the future trajectory than the current level. We came into the pandemic with a federal budget outlook that was unsustainable. You saw debt rising relative to GDP, the carrying cost of that debt rising relative to GDP, as far as the eye could see. And in those circumstances, we know that resources are not being used in the private sector. They're being pulled into the government, and the loss in innovation, investment, training, skills, ultimately slows the growth of productivity and slows the growth of the standard of living. Those are incremental costs that occur day by day. They're not noticeable at the time, but you look back and think, gee, we aren't the economy we could have been, and the debt's going to be one of those reasons. So it's important to get this under control. There's no appetite for it right now in Washington. You don't see anyone doing that. And I'm concerned about the fact that the Biden administration and the Congress at the moment are contemplating these bills, which would create a further structural deficit. I mean, they are not fully paid for. If the spending programs are put out over 10 years, the taxes don't come close to the $5.5 or $6 trillion that you need. And so we're building in a bigger problem than the one we already had. And that doesn't seem wise to me.
Douglas, the president talked a lot about the price of gas and, AAA just yesterday in California, the most expensive state, it was $4.40 a gallon on average. Nationwide, it's roughly $3.19, $3.20 a gallon. The CPI number shows that the largest increase in inflation is energy. Whether they extract that from the numbers we report or not, people pay that. Is President Trump tapping into something that perhaps the Democrats are missing?
Yes. This is an politically very salient point. The inflation that people feel is the top line CPI inflation. And 50% of the CPI basket is shelter, food and energy. And that's been up by almost 10% in the first half of this year at an annual rate. And, there's still substantial inflationary pressure in that measure. So it's a very, very powerful piece of the political dynamic. He's tapping right into it. He showed his usual obsession with getting the details right, but politics he's got exactly right.
Doug, it always amuses me to some extent when you hear folks of President Trump's age harken back to the Jimmy Carter era when they talk about inflation, because obviously inflation, the trajectory is the same, but the magnitude is just nowhere near in the same ballpark as it was at that time. That said, okay, so if energy prices are going up, and if that's what people are feeling, what do you do about that from a policy and legislative perspective?
So this is one where the Biden administration has sharply changed course. I mean, there's no question about it. They have stated flatly, the president himself said, climate is the number one priority. Their approach to climate is to demonize and or take off the portfolio particular fuel sources, coal, natural gas, oil.
But that's not why oil prices are going up today, because of their climate policy plans that they're making.
Asking OPEC to do the pumping and not do it in the U.S., which has the capacity to do it. So if they've set down that course, they're going to have to deal with the trade-off. And one of the trade-offs is the lack of access to low-cost petroleum and especially natural gas as part of the transition. And that's going to be a tough thing politically.
The other issue that, and this is from the Congressional Budget Office, that $1,300, they estimate that the tariffs have thrown that onto the average American family. And nobody's talking about removing those tariffs. How does that play going forward?
This is the opposite of climate. They have basically kept in place the Trump international agenda. And they are supposed to today reveal their trade strategy. All of the leaks that I've heard do not include getting rid of any of the tariffs that many people decried at the time. Then the national security reason for steel and aluminum tariffs. I mean, that at the time people thought that was ludicrous. They're still in place. The China tariffs, which was really a bilateral brinksmanship game that no one really thought would work out, but they're not changing any of that. It'll be interesting to see how they go forward and what they call their strategy. But the nuts and bolts of it are the same as we've seen for a while.
Douglas, the former president stopped short of saying the inflation we are seeing in the country right now, gas prices, you name it, could tip us into a recession. But if this inflation continues at current levels, is a recession in the cards for the country over the next 18 months?
So the issue, I think, is policy errors. I think the inflation really is a flat-out policy error. The American Rescue Plan, 1.9 in stimulus in March, was at a time when the economy was growing at 6.5%. In the second quarter, it continued to grow at roughly 6.5%, but we saw inflation pick up sharply. The question is, what kind of legs will it have? And if you look at this, the supply chains, producer prices are going up at very high rates, and there seems to be some durability to it. That raises the specter of the Fed having to move quicker than it intended, having to move from, the taper to rates faster than intended. And in that process, there's always the chance for policy error. And I think that's the real risk.
All right, let's leave it there. Douglas Holtz Eakin, president at the American Action Forum. Good to see you this morning. And thank you to Adam Shapiro for bringing us that exclusive interview with former President Donald Trump.
One thing that people do seem to be still going out and buying a lot of, it looks like, soda and snacks.
That much is for sure. And in true trademark form, PepsiCo is out with better than expected third quarter earnings results this morning. Growth was largely driven by another quarter of strong demand for beverages and snacks in emerging markets. The company did see slowing growth in its beverage business and called out it's dealing with volatile inflation just like many other large companies right now. And as we just highlighted here, PepsiCo Vice Chairman and CFO Hugh Johnston joins us for a deeper look into the quarter. Hugh, good to see you fresh off your earnings call. I was definitely on it, of course. Something really caught my attention here before we even get into the quarter. You came out here and I would say not trademark form, provided 2022 guidance saying that you are looking for growth in line with the long-term algorithm of the business. For investors not familiar with that algorithm, how fast do you see sales and profits growing next year, and why is that the case?
Yeah, happy to be with you, Brian. Good morning to everyone. Our long-term guidance on revenue has been mid-single-digit revenue growth and EPS high single-digit growth on a core constant currency basis. It is unusual for us. I think given the volatility, there were more questions out there than you would typically have at this time of year. Normally, we don't talk about the following year until February. But given just the sort of open questions that were out there because of all the volatility, we made a decision to provide investors with some clarity as best we can see it as we go into next year. So we do expect to see mid-single-digit revenue, high single-digit core constant currency EPS. And we think that'll be a terrific result, especially on top of what's been a really, really strong 2021.
Yeah, Hugh, I had to go run across my other room here to grab my pen. I did not expect to hear that from you guys here. But you also brought up, too, and I suspect this plays somewhat of a role in your bullish outlook here, with consumers. You are seeing consumers essentially go into grocery stores and not showing much resistance to the price increases that you've put into the market. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think a variety of reasons, some of which are specific to us. We really have been investing heavily in our brands, and we've been investing heavily in innovation across really all of the various subcategories that we play in, snacks as well as beverages. And I think we're providing products that consumers are willing to pay more for. So, with the differentiation that we have and with the fact that our brands are as loved as they are, I think there is a willingness to pay more for those types of products. In addition to that, I think more broadly, consumers to some degree have been conditioned to price increases across a variety of categories. There's really no company that's immune to what's been happening in terms of commodity as well as operating expense inflation, and everyone's prices are going up a little bit. In a world where prices are increasing, again, on a relative basis, our prices are still somewhat low. And as a result of that, we're that simple treat or that simple pleasure that people choose to enjoy. And it's worth it to them to pay a little bit more for it. So the elasticity has been relatively low on these price increases, and I expect that'll be the case across 22 as well.
I want to pick up, Hugh, it's Julie here. I want to pick up on that last point in particular, because as you're talking about having more visibility into 2022, are you going to continue to be raising prices incrementally next year? Because as you know, this isn't just a question, of course, about Pepsi. It's a question about the U.S. economy and about the persistence of inflation. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Julie. Thanks for asking. So the way we've handled our price increases, we did increase prices a bit in the summer on the Gatorade business. The beverage business more broadly had some price increases in September across just about all of the product lines. And then the snack food business really increased prices in October. The way that we work in terms of our commodity inflation is we tend to buy about 6 to 9 months in advance. So by the time we get to February, we've got pretty good visibility into what the rest of the year looks like. My expectation is there'll probably be one more round of price increases in the first quarter as we sort of finalize what the cost outlook looks like. And we also get a better feel for what the consumer outlook is in 22.
And Hugh, can you drill down into that commodity inflation for us a little bit? As I was talking about, I don't know if you heard before your segment, but we were talking about oil prices now in the U.S. pushing towards $80 a barrel. There are some forecasts that we could even get to $100 a barrel in the fourth quarter. Now, if you're buying 6 to 9 months in advance, that would put you up, you know, beyond the first quarter next year with seeing potentially a significant increase again in commodities.
Yeah, so as I said, we are generally 6 to 9 months out. In addition to that, our commodity basket is pretty broad. There's no individual commodity that even makes up 10% of the basket, so we buy a pretty wide variety. It's tough to sort of pick one commodity and understand the impact on our overall basket. When it comes to what our expectations are for commodities in 22, we'll talk about all that in February when we have a better sense for it. But I do think we certainly expect some inflation based on the forward buying that we've done already into next year.
Hugh, lots of discussion on the earnings call this morning about your efforts with Hard Mountain Dew, your initial foray into the alcohol market. When does that drink, when will that hit the market? And then secondarily, you did note on the call that you have a pipeline of products here. So it sounds to me you're going to be making a broader push into the industry, right?
Well, as we noted on the call, it's a very big category. It's a category with lots of attractive characteristics, both financially and from a consumer perspective. And it's in an area that we're familiar with. We wanted to make sure that we had a partner that we felt like we could collaborate well and innovate well with. And Boston Beer is terrific in that regard. Dave Berwick, who is the CEO of Boston Beer, is a former PepsiCo executive. He understands his business and he understands what we do pretty well. So we kind of see this as a really interesting opportunity. And we're hoping it's a really big opportunity. So we'll see how it plays out over time. You'll see the first products in the first half of next year, and then we'll take it from there and see how big we can make it.
All right, fair enough. And also, too, we talked when you announced the sale of the Tropicana division. How do you plan to use those proceeds? And are there other parts of the business you're looking at for divesting?
No other plans to divest anything else. I'll clear that one right away. In terms of the use of proceeds, what we've said is, look, we're losing some EBITDA, so obviously we're going to pay down some debt as a result of that. In addition to that, given the growth in the company right now, we're going to invest in organic CapEx to help continue to facilitate the growth that we're experiencing. So those will be the primary use of proceeds.
To ask our Anjali Kamlani to repeat it during the commercial break because it's an interesting and surprising piece of news. For the first time, a healthcare company is going to be headlining the Consumer Electronics Show. And Anjali had the chance to speak to said health company and the head of it. Anjali, tell us about it.
That's right, Julie. So the new CEO of Abbott Laboratories, who has taken over and just a year later is faced with this very interesting announcement, spoke to me in his first ever wide-ranging interview about taking the helm of the company in the middle of a pandemic, as well as what this really means, the significance of a healthcare company and what that means for the health tech sector largely. Listen to what he had to say and more.
Well, I'm really excited. Abbott's very excited to be able to deliver the keynote at the CES 2022, especially since it'll be a live event this year. And it's really important because we're the first healthcare company ever to deliver that keynote address. And I think it's very appropriate. I think it's very timely that a healthcare company does deliver that keynote. Obviously, for two reasons. One, we've been through this incredible experience with the COVID and the pandemic, and the importance of health is front and center for sure. But I also think it's important because of this convergence we're seeing between healthcare technology and digital technology coming together. That's a clear trend that's been occurring for the last at least 5, 6 years that we've been seeing. So I think it's very timely and appropriate for us to be able to be part of this.
Absolutely. And that, of course, has come front and center really in the middle of the pandemic. So I want to ask you about that. Let's start with that first, which is you taking the helm of Abbott in the middle of the pandemic. We knew that you were going to be taking over well before, but the pandemic just sort of came in the middle. What was that like? What were some of the things that you sort of had conscious moments of that you couldn't believe were happening?
Well, I'd say, first of all, there was no playbook for this. So I think not only new CEOs like myself, but even very experienced CEOs, we were all kind of really having to make decisions with a new set of experiences and learning a lot as we made those decisions. But I would say for me, specifically for Abbott, I took over a company that was in really great shape. We had tremendous organic growth. We had a very rich pipeline. A lot of health technology that we were developing. So I took over a company that was in really great shape. I think another key aspect of that is mission and purpose. And that's so important today for both for me and obviously for all the Abbott employees. And to be at a healthcare company during a pandemic, it's almost like, okay, this is when your number is really being called. This is for moments that Abbott was built for. So I think that was very powerful for all of us to reconnect to our mission and our purpose. And I have a great team. We have a great, passionate group of employees and a team that's dedicated and committed. So while there wasn't any playbook, if you put all those kind of components together, it definitely made navigating a little bit easier, but there were definitely some challenges for sure.
I can imagine. I wonder, of course, being in the pandemic led to a lot of really interesting sort of changes in consumer behavior, one of those specifically being health tech. And I know that's something that really is a big part of the company, but let's focus on the product itself that really gave the attention to Abbott, and that's the Binax Now Rapid Test. Started off really helping support government efforts, and now they're on the shelves. They're accessible to everyone. And this is coming at a time where, we've seen this pivot from consumerism and at-home tests, which were sort of a niche market before. Do you feel like this is an area that Abbott can really capitalize on?
Well, for sure. I think we've long believed in the trend to decentralize some of the testing. It's not an either or, it's an and. So a lot of testing historically has been done in hospitals and labs. And what we see now with COVID is this trend to be able to add on a different type of testing, one that's a little bit more decentralized, that consumers can go to a pharmacy or they can go to a physician's office, airports and hotels, right? So there's this complete decentralization, which I think is very positive for the entire diagnostic business. We also talk about the digitization of it, right? And we've seen a lot of that connectivity of medical devices with digital. And what you saw in COVID was Abbott's understanding of the importance of that digitization. So not only do we develop the Binax test, but we also developed a companion app called Navica that connects the test with your phone so that you can have your green pass to say, hey, I've tested and I've been tested negative. So I think that's an important aspect of it. And then the third piece I would say, Anjali, is this aspect of democratization. And it's a word that gets thrown out there, but we really truly believe in that. So when we launched Binext, if you remember, a lot of the rapid tests were costing $100, $150 to get a test. And we went out and we launched at $5 to really make it accessible and be able to build scale. So I think those three aspects, digitize, democratize, and decentralize, Not only did you see that with COVID, but ultimately that's our vision. That's our view of how healthcare technology and digital technology will be able to come together.
Obviously, we've known and seen throughout the pandemic that health technology and devices generally accessible to consumers has really seen a huge growth. So it seems like Abbott is ready to capitalize on that. Back to you guys.
Anjali, thanks so much for bringing us that conversation. Appreciate it.
Teens are loving makeup, wearing shoes from Crocs and Nike, eating goldfish in Nature Valley bars, and surfing around on Amazon and Netflix a whole bunch. That is just a small sampling of the takeaways from Piper Sandler's latest Taking Stock with Teens survey. Piper Sandler's senior research analyst Aaron Murphy is here with more details. Aaron, always enjoy reading this report. 10,000 teens surveyed, so a large sampling size is always here. Anything surprise you hear from the survey?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. There were a number of surprises this fall. I think what was important about this survey, though, is this is one of the first surveys that we've done for a couple of years that teens are going back to the classroom. So I think it does give some insights on what could a new normal look like. So 91% of teens were back in classroom in person, another 5% in a hybrid format. We did see a preference for specialty retail tick up. 30% of teen time is allocated to the mall or to specialty retail, which did surprise us. And we saw a lot more interest this fall in apparel, in footwear, in accessories. So we feel very strongly that we're in the midst of a multi-year replenishment cycle as it relates to the wardrobe. So I'd say those were some of the key takeaways on the positive side. On the slightly negative side, and again, maybe not too surprising because consumers are getting out and about again, but video game consumption ticked down. We also saw personal care preferences start to evolve more towards hair care, more towards fragrance and away from cosmetics.
Aaron, I was surprised to see clothing is once again the top priority for teens, right? And you say in the survey, for the first time since fall of 2014, clothing, 22% of wallet share is number one. In case folks were wondering what it used to be, was food. Kids were going out and eating together, and it looks like they are spending more on clothing again. What are sort of the implications of that?
Sure. So I want to be clear, food is still very relevant, but it did tick down for the first time in 7 years below that of clothing. So I think as it relates to our coverage, you know, I cover the apparel, footwear, and some of the beauty stocks for Piper. You know, this is a very positive data point for apparel broadly. And so whether it's Nike taking new highs in our survey, whether it's Lululemon, again, we're in a casual cycle that hasn't come unwound just because we are moving through reopening. So we feel very firm about the casual apparel cycle that we're in. I think the other really fun anecdote is we talk to teens about what trends they're seeing in school. And we're seeing mentions of a lot of throwbacks to the 90s, whether it's mom jeans, whether it's high-waisted denim, looser, baggier fitted bottoms with crop tops. So there's a lot to be excited about that's new in apparel. And I think the consumer and the teen consumer in particular is excited to show it off.
Aaron, no way I'm going back and purchasing a few pair of JNCO jeans. I'm not reliving my 90s childhood and early 2000s. I'm not doing it. I refuse to. What is also interesting to me is that the survey pointed out 75% of teens are in households that have been vaccinated. That is up from 30% in the spring. You know, as you look to the holiday shopping season, this has to be an incredibly bullish point.
Yeah, we do feel bullish on the consumer demand into holiday this year. We think that there's appetite, as we talked about, for apparel, for footwear, for accessories, which also jumped up 10% year over year in terms of interest. The one caveat, and I think this is important, is inventory. Obviously, our survey speaks to consumer demand, not to what's happening in the supply chain, but inventory is very lean across the board as several brands have had challenges getting their inventory to North America. So keep that in your kind of back of your mind, but from a demand perspective, we feel very good about, you know, what we're seeing this early on in the season.
You know, I want to pick up on the inventory question because, of course, Nike is the big winner again. Nike is really perennially at or near the top in your survey. And as we know, Nike's got those inventory problems, right? It's having trouble with its factories in Vietnam. At what point do these kids get annoyed and try and turn to another brand, or does it just make Nike that much hotter for them?
It's a great question. I think the brand speaks for itself in our survey, hitting the top apparel brand again for 11 consecutive years, the number one footwear brand at 57% share, and even Converse, which Nike owns, picked up 300 basis points. So, you know, I think the scarcity historically has driven the model. Clearly, if you can't find any product, that's a problem, but there's a lot of secondhand platforms out there. StockX was the number three preferred website for teen, male teens. So there's a lot of interest in the brand that you may get, not just from the primary market, but the secondary market, which I think is a positive. Say more importantly, obviously post the last quarter, we do believe that they appropriately cut their guidance for the balance of the year and really kind of took a scorched earth scenario to it. So from here, we do think this is a buying opportunity. We think the supply chain, while pressured right now, will be transient. And the fact that this brand time and time again hits the top of this Gen Z demographic is the more relevant point here.
Aaron, I have 60 seconds left and two questions for you. So it has to be quick here. 9% of teens in the survey claim to have traded crypto. What do you make of that?
These teens are digital. They are figuring things out. I think of that 9%, you know, close to 80% were male. So it will be interesting to see how this changes going forward. The other really interesting stat was on NFT. So there was a similar kind of high single digit interest of you know, teen, again, more teen male purchasing NFTs. So a whole new set of kind of asset classes are emerging for this young generation.
And Aaron, lastly, this is blowing up on my Twitter feed. I tweeted it out there. Why the popularity in Goldfish?
My goodness, that's a great question for Michael Lavery, who covers it. But teens like to snack. I think they've been sitting at home for the last 18 months. And, you know, it is a top trend. But more on that later. We'll have to dig into if it's more of a TikTok trend. I would say that seems to be the golden wand that flashes across our survey and makes things move higher.
Always awesome work here. For the record, I am not a Goldfish fan. Piper Sandler, Senior Research Analyst Aaron Murphy, good stuff as always. At its Investor Day this morning, Dow will outline a new plan to boost operating profits by $3 billion. The company will also reiterate its 2050 carbon neutrality commitment. Let's get a behind-the-scenes look at this plan with Dow President and CFO Howard Ungerleider. Howard, good to see you as always here. Thanks for coming on. That is a big number, $3 billion in additional operating profits. What's the timeline on achieving that, and how do you get there?
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Brian. It's great to be back here on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. You know, we were last back here 3 years ago as we were getting ready to spin out the new Dow from DowDuPont. In the last 3 years, we've uplifted the earnings of the entire enterprise by $2 billion a year over the economic cycle. And Team Dow has delivered top quartile performance in cash flow conversion, in cost structure, in net debt reduction, and in shareholder remuneration. And as you pointed out with that question, what we're here today to talk about is the next several years, and that's $3 billion of additional uplift in earnings over the economic cycle. To answer your question, we'll see $2 billion of that, more than $2.5 billion of that over the next several years through 2025. And then the big announcement this morning is our first ever net zero carbon emission site in Alberta, Canada, where we're going to be decarbonizing the entire site and growing the earnings of that site. And we'll be doing that. That'll RTO in 2027 in first phase, and then 2029 in the second phase.
Pardon me, Howard, it's Julie here. RTO, in my world, that's return to office, but I think that's not what you mean here.
Ready to operate or return to
ready
operation.
To operate.
Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. That's all right.
Good to see you, Julie.
Good to see you too. How does that work? In other words, how do you make a chemical plant? You guys, as you said, making ethylene there. How does it operationally get to zero carbon emissions?
Yeah, so we're doing it primarily with an autothermal reformer and carbon capture. So basically, we've got an existing hydrocarbon cracker on the site today. As a part of this investment, we will be building a brand new world-scale cracker at that site as well. So it's a brownfield investment, lower risk, a higher return on invested capital project. And then connected to the cracker, we will put an autothermal reformer. What that autothermal reformer does is take off gas or waste gas from both crackers, turns it into hydrogen, and then that will take, that hydrogen will go back into the process. So we'll close the loop. And then we also will join the Alberta trunk line. Carbon capture has been a capability in Alberta for quite a while. So we'll take carbon capture and capture any of the carbon and then sequester and store that carbon. So that'll allow us to get probably 95% of the carbon off of the site. And then we'll do the rest either with alternative energy and or some offsets to close the gap from the 95% to the 100% to really make it a net zero emission site and the first ever net zero emission site around the world.
Howard, two of your largest investors are in fact Vanguard and BlackRock. They own collectively about 14% of your shares. You know, what are those meetings like now with these companies, both of which I would say are very focused on ESG?
Yeah, I mean, look, they're great. They're great investors. They've been with us for the long haul, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, certainly all the conversations that we have every quarter, the ESG component of it continues to increase. You know, we build, though, on a track record of strength. So we've set 10-year sustainability goals for now three decades, and we're in our 18th year of annual sustainability reporting with our intersections report that we just published several months ago. And to your point about in the open, our 2050 goals, right? So we set the 2050 goal to be carbon neutral across the entire enterprise, and then we set the interim goal to take another 15% of our carbon emissions down by 2030, and that's on a 2020 basis. And that builds on the first 15% reduction that we've already achieved from 2005 to 2020. And we've been able to do all of that reduction while we've also been increasing the earnings power of the company.
Howard, let's talk feedstock, shall we? In other words, the stuff that you guys use to make your products. As we've been talking about, commodity prices right now have been hot. We've seen oil prices go higher, natural gas prices go higher, et cetera, et cetera. How are you guys managing that? Are you raising your prices? Are you, how far out are you buying, for example? What are you doing?
Well, we're doing all of the above. I would say one of the benefits that we have as Dow is we've been investing in feedstock flexibility, literally asset by asset, furnace by furnace around the world. So we have the ability to crack different kinds of natural gas, whether it's the U.S. shale advantage or whether it's the Alberta project that we just talked about. That Alberta advantage is also a structural advantage and has been in place for probably five decades. We also are a major player in Bahia Blanca, Argentina, with gas there out of the Vaca Muerta shale fields. And then, of course, we have our investments in the Middle East as well. But feedstock flexibility is key. Obviously, we're dealing with inflation that almost everybody in every market sector is. And so we're no different. We are working to raise our prices to at least compensate for some of that higher feedstock cost. But on a relative basis, we are in a very good position because of that feedstock flexibility and our geographic diversity of our production.
Howard, yeah, to your point, I mean, inflation is really, it's sticking around and it's proving anything but transitory. The main, I would say, ingredient, if you will, and everything you do really is hydrocarbons. It is oil-based. You know, how concerned are you about this latest push higher in oil prices and your ability to forecast your business?
You know, well, I think, look, the reality is everything has got some inflation to your point. And I agree with your point that it doesn't feel very transitory at the moment. I mean, the reality is we came off of the pandemic where basically most of the industrial economy and the consumer economy shut down. And now the demand has snapped back much faster than pretty much everybody has predicted. And as a result, you know, if we could produce more, we could definitely sell more. So, you know, we're doing our best that we can to try to drive that supply growth. And then you manage it customer by customer, market by market, application by application. But I feel really good about the markets that we serve. So we participate today in about $650 billion worth of market opportunity. And the markets that we participate in, whether it's packaging, infrastructure, home and personal care, or mobility. These are markets that are growing 1 to 1.5 times GDP. So by 2025, that'll be north of $800 billion of market opportunity. So significant amount of growth potential for us.
I'll tell you, Howard, the split seems like yesterday. Good to see you down there at the New York Stock Exchange. Dow President and CFO Howard Ungerleiter. Have a great rest of the day.
Power sports company Volcan making its public debut today. And take a look at this chart. Shares are surging in its first day of trading, up just over 110%. The company listing on the NASDAQ today. So we want to bring in Volcan CEO Jordan Davis. We're also joined by Yahoo Finance reporter Pras Subramanian. Jordan, that move in the stock today, 110% gain that we're seeing. Clearly, congratulations on what is an exciting day for you. But what do you make of the enthusiasm that we're seeing from the street today?
Well, thank you for having me. Yes, we're very excited about this. You know, I think the enthusiasm comes from just a general enthusiasm for EV. You know, there's a big appetite for the various EV competitors out there. And I think the fact that we are 100% off-road EV power sport company and the only one listed on the NASDAQ just adds a little bit of excitement as well.
Hey, Jordan, Pras here, and congrats again on today's debut. So how big do you think the market is for electric power sports vehicles? And what kind of pre-order interest are you guys seeing so far?
So I think the market is healthy. I couldn't comment on the total, you know, volume. We see early demand as being very strong. We've been pre-selling vehicles now for quite a few months, and we have pre-orders of roughly 270 fully paid pre-orders. We continue to get a lot of feedback from both the marketplace and potential dealers about the excitement for the space and commentary around things like from the dealer base. We know that this is going to be a big chunk of the market. You know, I think that there used to be a perception that the EV technologies were emerging, right? But I think we're at a point now where EV technology is an accepted technology, especially in the vehicle space. So we think there's a very big appetite from a consumer for vehicles, both two wheel and four.
A lot of us love anything with wheels. And I have to ask you, I'm looking at the website right now, the 2022 Volcan Grunt. When we look at a vehicle like this, I would imagine that you're saving in the production of it because you don't have all the gears and all the components that an internal combustion type vehicle has. But the price, at least online, of $79.95, I mean, $7,900, does that put you out of the market for a lot of us who would love something like this?
You know, we don't think so. When we look at the competitive landscape, and there are other motorcycles, EV motorcycles out there, we actually under-index at our MSRP. So we think we're very competitive. Some of the other features that we offer on the bike are things that you're not going to get in a substitute product like a combustion engine bike. So we will be releasing an app, for instance, that is linked to the motorcycle that gives you on-the-fly tuning capabilities, navigation. It serves as your interactive dashboard, and we have a roadmap for that product that's going to offer other cool features for the user at the end of the day. So, you know, we go back to your comment about the complexity of build or the non-complexity of build. Yes, there's far fewer parts. You know, our bike has between 150 and 170 parts compared to the possible thousands that go into an internal combustion bike. But I think when you look at the fact that a customer doesn't have to change oil, change a spark plug, do any kind of technical work to the bike, that adds to the convenience. And that adds to what customers are willing to pay to have something that's both easy to ride and low maintenance and over the course of ownership, a pretty low cost of ownership.
Hey, Jordan, so you guys are based in Austin, Texas, building the bikes there. Are you guys committed to U.S.-based manufacturing? And so far, have you guys had any problems with component shortages and things like that?
Yeah, so we are proud to be in Texas, and we're proud to be built in the USA. One of the things that we are focused on is to continue production in Texas and try to source as many components domestically as possible. our bikes do have components from global supply chain. But as far as the continuity goes, we've been able to manage that very well. Now, we are facing the same supply chain shortages as, you know, the big three auto manufacturers, our own competitors in the power sports marketplace. There's no hiding from that right now. But we've got a really seasoned team, experienced team, and they've been able to navigate that well and keep us in parts.
Jordan, going off of that, I mean, have you had to change your strategy at all? I would imagine that maybe some things have been delayed as a result of the supply chain issues that you're not alone on it, but that the industry is facing at large.
So I think our strategy has remained the same from day one, which is to be a market leader in the space, and definitely the EV power sports leader eventually. As far as our distribution strategy goes, you know, we have made some evolutions over the last few months, mostly so that we're able to scale in the future and keep up with demand while being profitable and delivering the product. So, you know, early on, we were focused on 100% direct consumer model, and we continue to operate that way. We've actually been making deliveries now for about 3 weeks to consumers. We kicked that off on September 10th. We've also made some initial deliveries to retail. But going forward, we see a lot of value in partnering with the power sports dealership community and network, especially in the United States. It's well established. It's got a good track record of servicing customers and being able to provide an environment where they can test and see product and then have some place to go back to if they need, you know, accessories or service or any number of touch points. So as far as our corporate strategy goes, we really haven't pivoted there. But as far as distribution, yeah, we've taken a step back and looked at what makes more sense going forward.
All right, Jordan Davis, congratulations again. A big day for your company, CEO of Volcon. And of course, our thanks to Prowse Subramanian as well. Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. I'm Julie Hyman. We had a jobs report that came in below estimates, just 194,000 jobs added last month. Joining us now is Labor Secretary Marty Walsh to react to this report in what sounds like busy Washington there. Secretary Walsh, it's always great to see you and talk to you and get your perspective on this report. What's missing here, do you think, still? What is still holding back more jobs being added?
You know, I find this report that we're looking at today is a complex report, and I don't think it's as bad as what everyone's reporting. We look at the sectors. Obviously, we had 194,000 jobs, 317,000 in the private sector. We saw gains in manufacturing and retail that are good to see. In some other areas, the hospitality number, we about 74,000 job gain there. Unfortunately, it's under what people projected, and there's a direct correlation to the rise in the Delta variant. Also, in the educational sector, there's something going on there that we have to do some more research on, particularly the educational public sector number. I think a lot of people expected with school starting that would see that number a lot higher, and certainly that's the number was in some cases not as disappointing. I'll say it was disappointing.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to dig into with you a little bit. That decrease of 144,000 in local government education, 17,000 in state government education. You said you guys want to do a little bit more research on that. I mean, what does that look like? What steps do you take to try to figure out what happened there?
Well, I think just at first glance, looking at it, I think what we're seeing in the rest of the job market with the amount of jobs that are open and not having as much participation in the job market as we'd like, some of those folks that are not in the job market right now looking for work are part of those folks that would be working in the school department. You know, so I think that we have some work to do there, no question about it. Also, I mean, when we think about the times that we're living in, that we've added 5 million jobs, roughly 5 million jobs since President Biden has taken over. The unemployment rate is under 5%. If you compare it, which I know it's not a comparison, but you compare it to the Great Recession, it took us till 2016 to get under 5% in the Great Recession. In this particular case, the president and the administration, we've done it in about 19, 20 months. So we have work to do there. Also, on some bright sides, I mean, 3 months ago, I was on the show with you, talking about women participation, concerned about women coming back into the workforce. Today, the women unemployment rate is 4.2%, which is low. The black women unemployment rate, 7.3%, which is good. I mean, so we're seeing in areas that I had concerns about several months ago, we're seeing some of those sectors opening up and bringing more people on. But there's no question about it. There's still work to do here. And the issue that we're dealing with here today, what we're talking about, this is all over the world. I mean, this is other economies all over the world. They have the same situations, people not participating, people not coming back to work. So we still have some work to do here.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned the women in the workforce. I mean, women continue to leave the workforce for a number of reasons. We've been talking about it all morning long. What could the administration do to help alleviate these pressures?
Well, I think one of the things that the president did in the American Rescue Plan is make an investment in childcare. I think that's a big issue here in our country and lack of childcare. Secondly, I think the fact that schools opened last month, I think that helps people as well. And schools are in person, they're not hybrid this year. I think that's another help here. I think in some cases the higher wages are helping us as well, getting more and more people back into the, particularly women into the workforce. And then longer term, the Build Back Better agenda, the bipartisan, the Build Back Better bill that's being discussed right now and negotiated and debated right now. In that, there's investments in the CARES economy, getting people, more and more people, skills and job training to get in the CARES economy. That's one number this month that we saw also, and actually last month, lose people was the area of care, healthcare in hospitals and nursing, and also in assisted living facilities and nursing homes. That's concerning long term. Actually, it's concerning short term. We have people that need those facilities, and we're losing workers in those areas. So that's something that we all have to collectively get on.
Let's pick up on that, Secretary Welsh, because we have heard on an anecdotal basis that some workers are leaving professions where they're required to be vaccinated. I know my co-anchor Brian Sozzi knows some folks who are healthcare workers who where that has happened. I'm not suggesting that there should not be vaccination mandates, particularly when we're talking about healthcare. But what do you do about that if there are those people who just don't want to get vaccinated in order to have those jobs?
I don't think that sector is just about vaccination. I mean, the vaccination, what I'm hearing, the number of people that do not want to get vaccinated in that medical industry, we're talking 1-2%. I think that what people have gone through this last year and a half has really opened a lot of people's eyes. I had two conversations, very important conversations, over the last 2 months. One was in Arizona. I met with some hospital CEOs and the mayor of Phoenix, Arizona, and we were talking about the need for bringing more nursing on, the shortage we have. And I was talking to a doctor the other night, who's taking care of my mother from Mass General Hospital, and said, again, the nursing shortage. We have 60,000 people in this country that are on waiting lists to get into nursing programs. We need to alleviate that burden. We need to create pathways and get more programs open for nursing programs in our country, and also mental health services. In the Build Back Better agenda, there's a major investment in community colleges. We have an opportunity to partner community colleges with those waiting lists to create a pipeline of nurses and medical professionals in a very short period of time into an industry that needs it.
Yeah, that's a great point about the pipeline. Speaking of pathways, there's one other question I wanted to ask you about second chance workers. This is an area I've been exploring as of late, that is people who have criminal records, and both removing the stigma and the legal barriers to getting those folks back in the workforce and helping them fill some of these jobs. What do you think the federal government should and can do on that front?
Well, I think I'm going to say it to you right now. I mean, as a former mayor of Boston, a lot of the people that I brought working to meet with me in City Hall were people that were formerly incarcerated or struggling with addiction or struggling with substance use disorder. I'm asking employers to take a look at these folks, give them an opportunity, give them a chance, because some of the folks that we brought on City Hall, and I created some programs as mayor, the best workers you could ever have, because people want to rebuild their life, they want an opportunity. The problem is they don't have that opportunity, so I'm asking people to do that. Secondly, in the Build Back Better infrastructure bill that we're debating right now, or that's being debated right now on Capitol Hill, right over my shoulder, there is money, job force training money, in that for second chance programs and reentry programs. And we really, if we don't help people that are formerly incarcerated or incarcerated when they come out, you know what's going to happen? They don't have any opportunities. They go right back to the corner they came on, and they end up right back in jail. And if you ask any one of them and you say, "What do you need?" They need a chance. They need a job. So I'm asking people to help them.
Yeah, and that is definitely what I heard from workers who had gotten opportunities and were able to go back to work. Secretary Walsh, great to get some time with you this morning, as always. Secretary Marty Walsh of the Labor Department, really appreciate it.